Hello, my fellow Americans. My name is David, and this is the American Cyanide Show, where freedom rings and the left can suck it! In this episode, you're going to be listening to Federalist 10, probably the most influential paper to be written in support of the Union, in support of the Constitution, and in support of the representative republic that we have today. It was written by James Madison back in 1787, and it is absolutely brilliant. The paper is rather lengthy and there's a lot to cover, so I don't want to spend a lot of time in the introduction because I want to spend that time in the commentary that I do after the reading. As always, be on the lookout for those times change people don't moments. It should be easy this time around because there are a lot of them. All right, so without further ado, here's Federalist 10. I'll see you on the other side. Enjoy. Federalist number 10, the same subject continued. The Union as a Safeguard Against Domestic Faction and Insurrection. From the New York Packet, Friday, November 23, 1787, James Madison. To the people of the state of New York, among the numerous advantages promised by a well-constructed Union, none deserves to be more accurately developed than its tendency to break and control the violence of faction. The friend of popular governments never finds himself so much alarmed for their character and fate as when he contemplates their propensity to this dangerous vice. He will not fail, therefore, to set a due value on any plan which, without violating the principles to which he is attached, provides a proper cure for it. The instability, injustice, and confusion introduced into the public councils have, in truth, been the mortal diseases under which popular governments have everywhere perished, as they continue to be the favorite and fruitful topics from which the adversaries to liberty derive their most specious declamations. The valuable improvements made by the American constitutions on the popular models, both ancient and modern, cannot certainly be too much admired. But it would be an unwarrantable partiality to contend that they have as effectually obviated the danger on this side as was wished and expected. Complaints are everywhere heard from our most considerate and virtuous citizens, equally the friends of public and private faith and of public and personal liberty, that our governments are too unstable, that the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties, and that measures are too often decided not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority. However anxiously we may wish that these complaints had no foundation, the evidence of known facts will not permit us to deny that they are in some degree true. It will be found, indeed, on a candid review of our situation, that some of the distresses under which we labor have been erroneously charged on the operation of our governments. But it will be found, at the same time, that other causes will not alone account for many of our heaviest misfortunes, and particularly for that prevailing and increasing distrust of public engagements and alarm for private rights, which are echoed from one end of the continent to the other. These must be chiefly, if not wholly, effects of the unsteadiness and injustice with which a factious spirit has tainted our public administrations. By a faction, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. There are two methods of curing the mischiefs of faction, the one by removing its causes, the other by controlling its effects. There are again two methods of removing the causes of faction, the one by destroying the liberty which is essential to its existence, the other by giving to every citizen the same opinions, the same passions, and the same interests. It could never be more truly said than of the first remedy that it was worse than the disease. Liberty is to faction what air is to fire, an element without which it instantly expires. But it could not be less folly to abolish liberty, which is essential to political life because it nourishes faction, than it would be to wish the annihilation of air, which is essential to animal life because it imparts to fire its destructive agency. The second expedient is as impracticable as the first would be unwise. As long as the reason of man continues fallible, and he is at liberty to exercise it, different opinions will be formed. As long as a connection subsists between his reason and his self-love, his opinions and his passions will have a reciprocal influence on each other, and the former will be objects to which the latter will attach themselves. The diversity in the faculties of men, from which the rights of property originate, is not less an insuperable obstacle to a uniformity of interests. The protection of these faculties is the first object of government. From the protection of different and unequal faculties of acquiring property, the possession of different degrees and kinds of property immediately results. And from the influence of these on the sentiments and views of the respective proprietors ensues a division of the society into different interests and parties. The latent causes of faction are thus sown in the nature of man, and we see them everywhere brought into different degrees of activity, according to the different circumstances of civil society. A zeal for different opinions concerning religion, concerning government, and many other points, as well of speculation as of practice. An attachment to different leaders ambitiously contending for preeminence and power, or to persons of other descriptions whose fortunes have been interesting to the human passions, have in turn divided mankind into parties, inflamed them with mutual animosity, and rendered them much more disposed to vex and oppress each other than to cooperate for their common good. So strong is this propensity of mankind to fall into mutual animosities that where no substantial occasion presents itself, the most frivolous and fanciful distinctions have been sufficient to kindle their unfriendly passions and excite their most violent conflicts. But the most common and durable source of factions has been the various and unequal distribution of property. Those who hold and those who are without property have ever formed distinct interests in society. Those who are creditors and those who are debtors fall under a like discrimination. A landed interest, a manufacturing interest, a mercantile interest, a moneyed interest, with many lesser interests, grow up of necessity in civilized nations and divide them into different classes actuated by different sentiments and views. The regulation of these various and interfering interests forms the principal task of modern legislation and involves the spirit of party and faction in the necessary and ordinary operations of the government. No man is allowed to be a judge in his own cause, because his interest would certainly bias his judgment, and, not improbably, corrupt his integrity. With equal, nay, with greater reason, a body of men are unfit to be both judges and parties at the same time. Yet what are many of the most important acts of legislation, but so many judicial determinations, not indeed concerning the rights of single persons, but concerning the rights of large bodies of citizens? And what are the different classes of legislators but advocates and parties to the causes which they determine? Is a law proposed concerning private debts? It is a question to which the creditors are parties on one side and the debtors on the other. Justice ought to hold the balance between them, yet the parties are and must be themselves the judges. And the most numerous party, or in other words, the most powerful faction, must be expected to prevail. Shall domestic manufacturers be encouraged, and in what degree, by restrictions on foreign manufacturers, are questions which would be differently decided by the landed and the manufacturing classes, and probably by neither with a sole regard to justice and the public good. The apportionment of taxes on the various descriptions of property is an act which seems to require the most exact impartiality. Yet there is, perhaps, no legislative act in which greater opportunity and temptation are given to a predominant party to trample on the rules of justice. Every shilling with which they overburden the inferior number is a shilling saved to their own pockets. It is in vain to say that enlightened statesmen will be able to adjust these clashing interests and render them all subservient to the public good. Enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm. Nor, in many cases, can such an adjustment be made at all without taking into view indirect and remote considerations, which will rarely prevail over the immediate interest which one party may find in disregarding the rights of another or the good of the whole. The inference to which we are brought is that the causes of faction cannot be removed, and that relief is only to be sought in the means of controlling its effects. If a faction consists of less than a majority, relief is supplied by the Republican principle, which enables the majority to defeat its sinister views by regular vote. It may clog the administration. It may convulse the society. But it will be unable to execute and mask its violence under the forms of the Constitution. When a majority is included in a faction, the form of popular government, on the other hand, enables it to sacrifice to its ruling passion or interest both the public good and the rights of other citizens. To secure the public good and private rights against the danger of such a faction, and at the same time to preserve the spirit and the form of popular government, is then the great object to which our inquiries are directed. Let me add that it is the great desideratum by which this form of government can be rescued from the opprobrium under which it has so long labored and be recommended to the esteem and adoption of mankind. By what means is this object attainable? Evidently by one of two only. Either the existence of the same passion or interest in a majority at the same time must be prevented, or the majority, having such coexistent passion or interest, must be rendered, by their number and local situation, unable to concert and carry into effect schemes of oppression. If the impulse and the opportunity be suffered to coincide, we well know that neither moral nor religious motives can be relied on as an adequate control. They are not found to be such on the injustice and violence of individuals and lose their efficacy in proportion to the number combined together, that is, in proportion as their efficacy becomes needful. From this view of the subject, it may be concluded that a pure democracy, by which I mean a society consisting of a small number of citizens who assemble and administer the government in person, can admit of no cure for the mischiefs of faction. A common passion or interest will, in almost every case, be felt by a majority of the whole. A communication and concert result from the form of government itself, and there is nothing to check the inducements to sacrifice the weaker party or an obnoxious individual. Hence it is that such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. Theoretic politicians who have patronized the species of government have erroneously supposed that by reducing mankind to a perfect equality in their political rights, they would at the same time be perfectly equalized and assimilated in their possessions, their opinions, and their passions. A republic, by which I mean a government in which the scheme of representation takes place, opens a different prospect and promises a cure for which we are seeking. Let us examine the points in which it varies from pure democracy, and we shall comprehend both the nature of the cure and the efficacy which it must derive from the union. The two great points of difference between a democracy and a republic are, first, the delegation of the government in the latter to a small number of citizens elected by the rest. Secondly, the greater number of citizens and greater sphere of country over which the latter may be extended. The effect of the first difference is, on the one hand, to refine and enlarge the public views by passing them through the medium of a chosen body of citizens, whose wisdom may best discern the true interest of their country, and whose patriotism and love of justice will be least likely to sacrifice it to temporary or partial considerations. Under such a regulation, it may well happen that the public voice, pronounced by the representatives of the people, will be more consonant to the public good than if pronounced by the people themselves, convened for the purpose. On the other hand, the effect may be inverted. Men of factious tempers, of local prejudices, or of sinister designs may, by intrigue, by corruption, or by other means, first obtain the suffrages and then betray the interests of the people. The question resulting is, whether small or extensive republics are more favorable to the election of proper guardians of the public weal, and it is clearly decided in favor of the latter by two obvious considerations. In the first place, it is to be remarked that however small the republic may be, the representatives must be raised to a certain number, in order to guard against the cabals of a few, and that however large it may be, they must be limited to a certain number, in order to guard against the confusion of a multitude. Hence, the number of representatives in the two cases not being in proportion to that of the two constituents, and being proportionally greater in the small republic, it follows that if the proportion of fit characters be not less in the large than in the small republic, the former will present a greater option, and consequently a greater probability of a fit choice. In the next place, as each representative will be chosen by a greater number of citizens in the large than in the small republic, it will be more difficult for unworthy candidates to practice with success the vicious arts by which elections are too often carried, and the suffrages of the people being more free will be more likely to center in men who possess the most attractive merit and the most diffusive and established characters. It must be confessed that in this, as in most other cases, there is a mean, on both sides of which inconveniences will be found to lie. By enlarging too much the number of electors, you render the representatives too little acquainted with all their local circumstances and lesser interests, as by reducing it too much, you render him unduly attached to these, and too little fit to comprehend and pursue great and national objects. The federal constitution forms a happy combination in this respect, the great and aggregate interests being referred to the national, the local and particular to the state legislatures. The other point of difference is the greater number of citizens and extent of territory which may be brought within the compass of republican than of democratic government. And it is this circumstance principally which renders factious combinations less to be dreaded in the former than in the latter. The smaller the society, the fewer probably will be the distinct parties and interests composing it. The fewer the distinct parties and interests, the more frequently will a majority be found of the same party. And the smaller the number of individuals composing a majority, and the smaller the compass within which they are placed, the more easily will they concert and execute their plans of oppression. Extend the sphere, and you take in a greater variety of parties and interests. You make it less probable that a majority of the whole will have a common motive to invade the rights of other citizens. Or if such a common motive exists, it will be more difficult for all who feel it to discover their own strength and to act in unison with each other. Besides other impediments, it may be remarked that where there is a consciousness of unjust or dishonorable purposes, communication is always checked by distrust in proportion to the number whose concurrence is necessary. Hence, it clearly appears that the same advantage which a republic has over a democracy in controlling the effects of faction is enjoyed by a large over a small republic, is enjoyed by the union over the states composing it. Does the advantage consist in the substitution of representatives whose enlightened views and virtuous sentiments render them superior to local prejudices and schemes of injustice? It will not be denied that the representation of the union will be most likely to possess these requisite endowments. Does it consist in the greater security afforded by a greater variety of parties against the event of any one party being able to outnumber and oppress the rest? In an equal degree does the increased variety of parties comprised within a union increase this security. Does it, in fine, consist in the greater obstacles opposed to the concert and accomplishment of the secret wishes of an unjust and interested majority? Here again, the extent of the union gives it the most palpable advantage. The influence of factious leaders may kindle a flame within their particular states, but will be unable to spread a general conflagration through the other states. A religious sect may degenerate into a political faction in a part of the Confederacy, but the variety of sects dispersed over the entire face of it must secure the national councils against any danger from that source. A rage for paper money, for an abolition of debts, for an equal division of property, or for any other improper or wicked project will be less apt to pervade the whole body of the Union than a particular member of it, in the same proportion as such a malady is more likely to taint a particular county or district than an entire state. In the extent and proper structure of the Union, therefore, we behold a republican remedy for the diseases most incident to republican government. And according to the degree of pleasure and pride we feel in being republicans, ought to be our zeal in cherishing the spirit and supporting the character of Federalists. All right, so that was Federalist 10. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. It was a fantastic paper. It was a great argument for setting up a constitutional representative republic, not a democracy. Nothing drives me more crazy than when I hear our supposed civil servants, our supposedly wise elected leaders, congressmen, senators, presidents, say, it's our democracy, it's important. We don't have a democracy, and we do not have a democracy by design. We have a constitutional republic. There is a marked difference between a direct democracy and a representative republic. And one of the main things, one of the main advantages that a representative republic has over a democracy is a safeguard against factions, which is the whole point of Federalist 10. Now, James Madison defines a faction as a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. So it's basically a group of bad people trying to do bad things. When you're trying to deprive people of their liberty, when you're trying to deprive people of their property, you are in fact a bad person. And when you team up with other bad people to accomplish this goal, you are a faction as defined by James Madison. Now, factions can happen in any form of government, including a representative republic. As a matter of fact, we have factions today. You have a faction that has taken root in the Democrat Party, and it's slowly making its way inside the Republican Party. I'm seeing the signs, and it's kind of scary, and that is of socialism. Now, you have some Republicans giving lip service to, oh, socialism is bad, but these Republicans are Republicans in name only. They are squishes. when they have an opportunity to fight against the socialism, they hide. They cave. They're nowhere to be found. They do not have the spine to stand up against the tyranny of socialism. They don't have the testicular fortitude to stand up against, say, the squad in the Democrat Party. They don't have the integrity to stand up against Nancy Pelosi and other socialists in the Democrat Party. So you have a faction right now trying to undo all the good that this country has accomplished in its short existence, short in comparison to other countries out there like England and France, Germany, who have been around for centuries. We've been around for 250 years. We are still young compared to other nations in the world. But we have done more good. We have accomplished more things in our short lifespan than all those countries did in their entire existence. And the reason we've been able to do that is because we have a representative republic that keeps idiotic factions like the squad in check. But what that requires is wise statesmen. And James Madison acknowledges that it is vain to say that enlightened statesmen will be able to adjust these clashing interests and render them all subservient to the public good. Enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm. We don't have enlightened statesmen right now in Congress at all. Maybe Josh Hawley and a handful of others who actually stood up on January 6th and said, no, the election results are not certifiable. We should not be certifying these results from Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania because those elections were conducted unconstitutionally. I live in Georgia. I don't like that my vote participated in a illegal election. The rest of the country has suffered because Congress, who was supposed to put a stop to states doing something wrong, they were the last check, but their excuse was it's a threat to our democracy. No, they put our republic in peril. They are the insurrectionists. They are the traitors. They betrayed their oaths of office. They were supposed to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and they failed miserably on January 6th. And they used the riot as an excuse to forsake their oath. That's stupid. That is completely idiotic. You don't do the wrong thing just because you're scared. In any case, there's a lot of good stuff in Federalist 10. Normally what I do at the close is I go through some times change people don't moments. Like I said at the beginning, there's a lot of them. They're very easy to find in Federalist 10. I consider the whole paper a huge times change people don't moments scenario. But let me go through some of the highlights that I found as far as times change people don't moments. As long as the reason of man continues fallible and he is at liberty to exercise it, different opinions will be formed. As long as the connection subsists between his reason and his self-love, his opinions and his passions will have a reciprocal influence on each other, and the former will be objects to which the latter will attach themselves. We are all unique. We are all individuals. We're all going to have our own opinions. We're all going to have our own ideas as to how to live our lives. And this is fine. But there are going to be people that want to make us all the same, because they think that only by making us all the same, then all our problems will be solved. Madison writes, "Theoretic politicians who have patronized this species of government have erroneously supposed that by reducing mankind to a perfect equality in their political rights, they would, at the same time, be perfectly equalized and assimilated in their possessions, their opinions, and their passions." James Madison is talking about socialism before socialism was even a thing. It's one thing to have equal rights. It's one thing to have equal protection under the law. That is a net good. That is a positive. That is what conservatives actually believe. That is what patriots actually believe. Every American has equal rights. Every American has equal protection under the law. But what we do not have the right to is somebody else's property, which is what socialism calls for. And that is one of the factions that we are dealing with right now in the Democrat Party. Socialism is entrenched deeply in the Democrat Party right now. There's another faction in the Democrat Party, which I don't think it's a faction anymore. It's just the party as a whole. The Democrat Party want to kill babies in the womb, which is wholly immoral. It is wholly ungodly to kill babies in the womb. But again, Madison warns that once a faction takes root and has become the majority, it doesn't matter whether it's a republic or a democracy or a monarchy or whatnot, once the faction, once the bad seed becomes the majority, if the impulse and the opportunity be suffered to coincide, we well know that neither moral nor religious motives can be relied on as an adequate control. They are not found to be such on the injustice and violence of individuals and lose their efficacy in proportion to the number combined together, that is, in proportion as their efficacy becomes needful. We make the religious and moral argument all the time against abortion. Now, it seems to be working, and this is where the advantage of the Republic comes into play. There are some states now that are passing heartbeat bills, meaning that when the woman goes into Planned Parenthood and they do the ultrasound to find where the baby is at, and there's a heartbeat, they can't perform the abortion because that baby is alive. There are some states that are doing that, and fantastic. And these states are free to do that because there's no federal law. There's nothing in the Constitution preventing them from doing that. Because thank goodness in the Constitution, there's not an amendment there that says that it's perfectly okay to kill babies. There's no legal right in the Constitution to kill babies in the womb. States know this, and states have the power to enact their own laws as long as they're not in contradiction to the Constitution. That is the system that we have set up, that James Madison fought for, that Hamilton fought for, that Jay fought for, and others fought for. So we have a stop. We have a way to stop these factions that want to instill socialism, these factions that want to make it so that babies can be killed willy-nilly. We have a way to stop it. And the vast majority of Americans are actually against abortion, despite what the left says. The vast majority of people are against abortions. So we are winning the moral argument. It's just taking time because we have so many entrenched career politicians in Washington, D.C. right now who would, like I said, would much rather do the easy thing rather than the right thing. And a lot of these people are corrupt. Men of factious tempers, of local prejudices, or of sinister designs may, by intrigue, by corruption, or by other means, first obtain the suffrages and then betray the interests of the people. Let me translate that for you liberals because it had a lot of big words in there and I'm sure you're all confused. What did he say? It's okay. I'm here. I will translate. Men of factious tempers, bad people. Of local prejudices or of sinister designs, racists, you know, it may by intrigue, by corruption, or by other means, election fraud, cheating, bribery, first obtain the suffrages, first get the votes, and then betray the interests of the people, stab them in the back. So let me give you a modern day example. Let's pretend for a moment that Joe Biden's victory on November 3rd is legitimate. We'll pretend that for a minute. You know, the left is really good at playing pretend. I'm pretty good at playing pretend too. So let's pretend that Joe Biden's victory was legitimate. During the campaign, he started out by saying that he's going to ban fracking, that he's going to make it more difficult for domestic energy production because it's not green. We got to go green. We got to do the windmills. We got to do solar. So oil and fossil fuels are going to go away. So fossil fuel workers went to Biden and said, that's going to cost me my job. So why are you saying these things? And Joe Biden turns around and says, I never said that. President Trump called him on it during a debate. Biden again doubled down on his lie. I never said that. I never said I was going to do away with fossil fuels. And the unions bought it, and the unions went to the union members and said, nah, you should probably still vote for Biden because he's not going to do away with fossil fuels. He said so. So by corruption or by other means, Joe Biden obtains the votes of the people. And what is one of the first things that he does? he cancels the XL pipeline. You know, the big old pipeline coming from, you know, Canada, going through our country, going all the way down to the Gulf to make it easier to transport petroleum in our nation, increase our oil production so that it brings gas prices down. Yeah, that thing. Yeah, that he killed it within a day or two of him being, quote, sworn in, unquote. He went back on his word and killed thousands of jobs just like that, without giving it a second thought. And the unions went, "Hey, what happened?" Well, we tried to tell you, idiots. Biden is a liar. Biden is a plagiarist. Biden is a clown. And you believed him? We had him on video saying that he's going to eliminate fossil fuels. He was lying when he said he never said it. We have it on video. But you union people, you're supposed to know better. So, hey, vote for Biden. He's going to protect our jobs. Yeah, no, he didn't. So congratulations, morons. Thanks to you, a lot of places are now paying $3, $4 a gallon in gas. Thanks to you, idiots. Thanks to a weak-kneed Congress who didn't stand up to the illegitimacy of the Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Michigan election results. They should have done it, but they didn't because they were weak. Josh Hawley and a handful of others, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene was another one, there was a handful of representatives, all Republicans, all strong conservatives, who said, no, these elections were not legitimate. And people are trying to get them to resign. They want them arrested. They're being called seditionists, insurrectionists, traitors, all manner of names. And like I said earlier, the ones that the ones that betrayed their oaths, the ones that went back on their word, were everybody else who voted to confirm the election. One last times change people don't moment. And again, this is James Madison fighting against socialism before socialism was a thing. A rage for paper money, for an abolition of debts, for an equal division of property, or for any other improper or wicked project will be less apt to pervade the whole body of the union than a particular member of it, in the same proportion as a malady is more likely to taint a particular county or district than an entire state. You have a faction in the Democrat Party right now, and it's taking root, and it's becoming the majority Democrat position to eliminate, for example, student debt. Student debt is basically some guy or gal went and got themselves a loan so they could go to college. Okay, can't fault them for that. But then decided to get a degree that's not marketable. And now they can't get a lucrative job and are having a hard time paying back the loan. And now they're demanding that you and I pay for said loan. I don't think so, Scooter. You took out the loan. You are responsible. But no, not according to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her merry band of idiots. They want you and I to pay for the loans. They don't think it's fair. Well, no, it's not fair that we pay for it. That is an improper and wicked project. Equal division of property, wealth redistribution, that's socialism. Paper money, that's actually on both the Democrat and the Republican side. Both don't want to go back to a gold standard. They like it the way it is, even though our national debt is going completely out of control. It's going off the rails right now. They just passed a $2 trillion bill that is supposed to help the American people, but only about 10% of that money is actually going to the American people. The rest of the money is going, we don't know where, but it's probably going to go back to line their pockets somehow. And there are people out there going, oh, the government is giving us $1,400. They're so nice. Yeah, it cost $5,000 to get you that $1,400. It cost me $5,000 so that you could get $1,400. And it cost you $5,000 so that I could get $1,400. That is not a good deal. But unfortunately, you have a maleducated population today. You have a brainwashed population today, that doesn't understand this. They only see, oh, I got $1,400. Yeah, but it costs you $3,600 to get that $1,400. You're in the hole $3,600. Am I doing the math right on that one? Or is it you're still in the hole $5,000? So in reality, it's $6,400 per person if that's going to be the math. So $6,400 per person, we only get to keep $1,400 of that. The other $5,000, where is it going? Where is it going? It's going to go line the pockets of the very people who are in charge of our taxes. We have a republic, and it's still strong. We can still save it. We just have to fight for it. We have to make sure that our states pass, like Georgia just passed, election integrity laws to prevent the idiocy that happened in 2020 from happening again. We need voter ID. We need limited mail-in voting. No ballot harvesting. These are common sense approaches to ensure that our elections are safe and that our elections are fair. But according to the Democrats, they're racist. Why are they racist? Well, you're telling people that they need to get IDs, and you know, black people have a hard time getting IDs. Why do black people have a hard time getting IDs? Because why? Why do black people have a hard time getting IDs? I have yet to meet a black person that doesn't drive. And in order to drive, you have to have a driver's license, which is a form of state-issued ID. So please tell me, why is it difficult for black people to get IDs? Hey, it's a poll tax. No, it's not a poll tax, because you are required to show ID for other things other than just to vote. You're required to show ID when you want to purchase a firearm. You are required to show ID when you want to purchase alcohol and tobacco. You are required to show ID when you're signing up for government services like welfare, unemployment. You're required to show ID when you open up a bank account, when you go cash a check. If you're getting a government check in the stimulus, if it's not being directly deposited into your account, you're getting a paper check, which requires you to have an ID when you go cash it. So how is it racist to ask for ID when you go to vote, but not to ask for ID for all these other services that I just mentioned? It's not a poll tax, and it's not racist. It is just a petty excuse by brainwashed idiots and their leaders. This faction that wants to usurp power from the people, it is merely an excuse to make it easier for them to cheat. And they don't like the fact that voter ID makes it harder. So they want to get rid of it because they want to be able to cheat just as easily as they did in 2020. So anyway, those are my thoughts on Federalist 10. I did cover a little bit of the times change, people don't moments. There, like I said, there are a lot more in there. I just didn't want to take up too much of your time. So let me know what you think were times change, people don't moments. We'll probably agree very easily. Like I said, the entire paper is a times change, people don't moments. It's a very good warning against the dangers of a direct democracy and factions in the majority. And thank goodness that we have a representative republic, because if it wasn't for that, this country would have fallen apart years ago. So like I said, that's it for this episode, folks. I want to thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for your patience. If you want to give me any feedback, I'll be more than glad to get it from you. You can email it to me, dave@americancyanide.com. You can also go to my podcast page, which is you can find it at show.americancyanide.com. That's the website, show.americancyanide.com. And on there's a link to send a voice message. So you can record yourself telling me how badly I'm doing, and then I'll play your message. Maybe, you know, if it's humorous enough, I'll play it. Anyway, you can follow me on CloudHub. You can follow me on Parler. My handles there are the same, @AmericanCyanide. Send me private messages through there, or just tag me on your posts, whatever the case may be, whatever you want to do. It's all good. So I also have a video channel on rumble.com. Just look for the American Cyanide Show. I have some videos there about other stuff that, you know, flowing thoughts that I have. So that's how you can get me. All right. If you would be so kind as to please rate the podcast in whatever app you're using, leave a comment, share the podcast with your friends and family, that would be appreciated as well. All right. So again, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for your patience. Remember, America is worth fighting for. And as always, be strong, be blessed, be still and know.